Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and welcome back to an adventure in history. We're so glad you're with us tonight.
You got spring break fever.
I do. It's nice. It's nice to have spring break.
Were you just changing the name of the show?
I was.
All right. So we got nothing to plug. We got nothing to talk about.
Just, you know, we're so happy it's March.
We are happy. It's almost
spring break
April.
Should be 2 weeks, though. I think that 1 week just is not quite enough.
I think some people might argue the other way.
That's true. That's true.
Get all these kids out of the house.
They know.
Too much craziness. So shall we get right to it then?
Yes.
Do you have a word?
Okay. This is a lost word, an old word. We're bringing it back. Today's word is compeer.
Compeer.
C-O-M-P-E-E-R. It's a noun.
A compeer. That is somebody who you are competitive with that is a peer.
Ooh, you're so close because the peer is a hint in this one, mm-hmm. but it's a close companion, comrade, or ally. A compeer. So a peer.
Okay.
Close companion.
I like that one. I like that we just shortened it to peer.
Hey, compeer. Well, this is like an extra, it's a close companion though. Like a peer is like, I thought
maybe you were talking about like the compeers that used to be at Sunday Market and at the Chamber of Commerce.
Oh, compeers.
Yeah. Do you remember?
No.
John Compeer and I think his wife was Joyce.
Okay.
It's not
that
spelled,
was their name.
It's not spelled P-E-E-R. It was spelled P-E-R-E.
My compeer, let's move on with our show because I don't know those people.
All right. I'm kind of surprised you don't know them.
No.
But anyway, okay.
Okay.
Let's see. So these are things that happened tomorrow, March 25th.
Yes.
So the big 2-5. 1509.
Ooh.
Henry Hudson embarks on an exploration for the Dutch East India Company to find a passage to India. I've always liked, he's not my favorite explorer, but he's up there. I've always liked Henry Hudson.
Okay.
They named a river after
him. They did.
And then they named a big giant bay up in Canada after him.
True.
Because his men mutiny and put him in like a little rowboat with a couple of guys that were loyal to him, and we never heard from him again.
Oh, yeah.
So, I don't know why, but I always kind of liked him. All right. So, Henry Hudson, 1609. 1774, Parliament passes the Boston Port Act. Closing the port of Boston and demanding that the city's residents pay for the nearly $1 million in today's value of the tea that was dumped in the harbor.
Oh, okay.
So I know I'm Johnny come lately to this, but on HBO, I think, John Adams, the miniseries from like 10 years ago, I guess. I'm finally watching it.
Okay.
And it's very well done.
Okay.
And I really like that they're portraying his relationship with his wife really well because she was really outspoken, really intelligent, and they were kind of they were a team.
Right.
And they're portraying that very well.
Well, and of course, John Adams. I mean, my maiden name's Adams, so kind of.
Are you related?
Probably.
Maybe.
Yeah.
You should check that out because that would make me.
Was he a good president or not?
I think he is.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And he's certainly one of the founding fathers that pushed for independence. And
true. Yeah. Yeah. And we liked her, of course. Yeah.
1882. The first demonstration of a pancake making held at a department store in New York City.
The first demonstration of pancake making.
So what I didn't do a deeper dive on, is that just like the first time that it's demonstrated? It's certainly not the invention of pancakes.
Or is this the precursor to like Costco like snacks, right?
I think it is.
Yeah, that's interesting.
All right. 1900, the U.S. Socialist Party forms in Indianapolis, of all places.
Okay.
1932, the verdict is announced in the Scottsboro case. And you probably don't know about this.
I didn't. I saw that on my list, too.
I kind of knew that I should know this, but I didn't really know the details. So the Supreme Court hands down its decision in the case of Powell versus Alabama. The case arose out of the infamous Scottsboro case. 9 young black men were arrested and accused of raping 2 white women on a train in Alabama. The boys were fortunate to barely have escaped a lynch mob sent to kill them, but were railroaded into convictions and death sentences. The Supreme Court overturned the convictions on the basis that they did not have effective representation.
Okay.
The alleged victims had concocted the charges out of thin air. One of them actually recanted her testimony. The accused boys were not given lawyers until the morning of the trial.
Oh, my gosh.
And the attorneys that they did have made almost no effort to defend their clients. And at the same day that the case began, the defendants were convicted and received death sentences. All white jury, of course, all white men.
And false.
On the same day.
Yeah.
That the jury, that the case begins, they're already found guilty.
Oh my goodness.
So the Supreme Court said, perhaps you should have better representation and earlier in the game.
Right.
So kind of a significant case.
And don't try everyone at the same time too,
yeah.
Right?
I mean, yeah. Then 1939, Billboard magazine introduces Hillbilly Music Chart.
Ooh.
That's what they called country music.
Oh, okay.
Hillbilly music.
Oh, how funny.
That kind of makes me laugh. 1939.
Yeah.
So,
one of the most popular genres in music now, though.
And are you a fan of the hillbilly music?
I am. I don't call it hillbilly, though. But I like country music.
I wonder what year they changed that and called it country instead of hillbilly.
Right.
But our history highlight of the day, the thing I think had the most impact on history, and we're going to talk about this.
Okay.
Even though it's not local, it has a huge impact, which is why it's my history highlight of the day. 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire kills 146 people in New York City.
Oh, okay.
And most people that study history, like at the college level at least, yeah, really know about this because it's such a landmark case. And
okay.
It's so significant.
All right.
So shall we get right to it? Or
so that's the deep tease.
Yeah. What did I miss before we get back
to
that?
No, you hit it all because, yeah.
Really?
You did.
Wow.
I know.
You didn't come prepared.
I did look. I did. I had some of those. Sometimes we're on the same page. I mean, that happens
it's
too.
It's always a little scary.
Yes.
All right. So the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. Like I said, it's really famous. And even though it's not something that happened in Astoria, Oregon, or Clatsop County, Oregon,
right,
it happens in New York, it still has such a lasting impact, even on today.
Okay.
So let's see. The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire occurred on March 25th, 1911, in the Ash Building, A-S-C-H, Ash Building in Greenwich Village, New York City. It killed 146 employees of the garment shop, most either recent immigrants or the children of recent immigrants, who had no choice but to work in sweatshops. Of the victims, 123 were female and 23 were male. The aftermath of the fire proved unions are a good thing, as it set in motion a number of protections for future garment workers. The fire was a catalyst for change and an example of industrialization gone wrong. It could have been prevented had anyone at City Hall or any of the shirtwaist factory owners cared enough to change the deplorable conditions of the building. Instead, what occurred was one of the worst factory fires in the United States. The fire wasn't an isolated incident by any means. Rather, it was one in a long series of historical disasters, in part attributable to the hubris, greed, and lack of oversight. Such man-made disasters, including those involving blimps, were common in the 19th and 20th centuries and often resulted in a chaotic aftermath. As for historical fires in the U.S., the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire is unequivocally one of the worst, particularly since the owners of the factory were found not guilty of any criminal charges. And before anybody kind of freaks out listening to this, I certainly understand many times it seems like the government overreaches and rules and regulations were overregulated, and it can be offensive when you're just trying to do something simple and what's the big deal? This one was a big deal. And this could have been prevented in so many reasons it should have been prevented that we're going to talk about.
Okay. The place was a tinderbox waiting to burn to start with. The workers at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory could smoke on the job as long as it didn't interfere with productivity. Of course, right? You know, it's 1911. The New York City fire marshal investigating the cause of the fire came to the conclusion that a lit match or cigarette was to blame. All it took was a wayward flame landing in one bin of flammable scrap fabric. The factory floors were filled with flammable material, including scraps of fabric and wooden baskets, and the fire spread very quickly. According to survivor accounts, many escaped to the roof and onto adjacent buildings. Others got out before the elevator became untenable. The fire started around 5 minutes before the 12-hour workday was over, and it spread very fast. Four different fire alarms were triggered within 15 minutes.
Can you imagine 5 minutes from your shift being over and you could have gone home?
Oh, and you're so tired too, right?
Exactly.
I mean, at that point, your brain's not working great, but one of the two stairwells in the building was inaccessible within 3 minutes. The filth and clutter of the factory floor helped the fire spread so quickly, some workers were found still seated at their stations, charred to death when all was said and done.
So another thing that happened, the factory's hose was rusted shut.
Oh, man.
Not long after the blaze started, a manager attempted to put it out with a hose located on the factory floor. The hose was old and rotted. Its valve rusted shut. It did nothing. Beyond a broken hose, there was nothing but a few buckets of water to fight the blaze. The fire extinguishers existed in the early 20th century. They were invented in England in 1723.
Wow.
And therefore could have been on hand in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, but no dice. Once the hose failed to turn on, the only thing left to fight the fire was a few buckets of water, which did nothing.
And only one elevator functioned properly. It's never a good idea to take an elevator when the building's on fire. However, in the case of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, it would have helped save at least a few lives. It's also a testament to the poor conditions of the building that only one of four elevators was working properly at the time of the fire. And that elevator was located down a very narrow hallway. When the fire broke out, garment workers, most of them women and girls aged 16 to 23, lined up to wait for the one working elevator, but it could only fit 12 people at a time, and despite making multiple trips up and down, it couldn't save most of them. Some of those waiting jumped to their deaths down the elevator shaft when it failed to reappear.
Isn't that terrible?
Oh, sad.
So the factory floor was a cramped nightmare. Sweatshops are known for hazardous working conditions, and the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory was no exception. To maximize profit, owners Isaac Harris and Max Bianc crammed as many laborers as possible into small spaces. The factory floor occupied the top three stories of the Ash Building and was a network of large machines and long tables arranged in a chaotic and tight-fitting maze. The arrangement of the three floors occupied by the factory made maneuvering difficult during a regular workday, let alone when a fire is going.
Right.
Once the fire broke out, the garment workers panicked, causing chaos. Avenues of escape were blocked off, and workers were trapped.
To make matters worse, doors leading out of the factory from staircases were locked. There were two main staircases in the Ash Building at the time of the fire. The doors to both were locked, ostensibly to prevent theft and to stop workers from taking unauthorized breaks. Those who escaped down the stairs and found locked doors burned to death in the stairwells. Of the 146 dead, 49 passed from smoke inhalation or were burned to death. To exacerbate things, all the doors in the building opened inward. The pile of those trying to escape crushed the workers closest to the doors against them, preventing anyone inside from opening the doors. This crush also made it impossible for firefighters to smash them open from the inside.
See, that's one of the major changes that happened.
Okay.
The doors always open out now, or are supposed to open out.
Oh.
Yeah. So the fire escape was weak, hazardous, and too narrow. The Ash Building had several design flaws and safety violations at the time of the fire. Not long before the disaster, the New York Board of Sanitary Control warned building operators of these violations, a warning that was ignored.
Hmm.
Among these violations were two issues with fire escapes. A, there weren't enough, and B, the existing one was poorly designed and constructed. As to the former point, for its size and capacity, the building should have had at least three fire escapes, but only had one. The sole fire escape serving the building was so narrow it would have taken hours for all the 500-plus workers in the factory to escape using it. Bizarre side note, the fire escape was built in place of a third staircase as a means of egress to appease city officials. Thanks to shoddy construction, the fire escape collapsed. Not long after the fire started, excessive weight, i.e. people using it, and heat made quick work of it. About 20 people were on the fire escape when it failed. All of them fell to their deaths.
Oh, man. Firefighters on the scenes didn't even have long enough ladders. The ladders brought to the scene by horse-drawn fire trucks were a few floors too short to be of any use to those trapped on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of the Ash Building. They only reached between the 6th and 7th floors. Workers who were waiting by or on windows for rescue by ladder quickly realized the futility of their efforts and elected to risk jumping rather than burn alive.
Oh, and how did that work out?
Right. Firefighter nets were overstressed by the weight of the leapers. Firefighters on the scenes had nets with which to catch those who jumped from the building during the fire. The nets were both poorly constructed and not equipped to handle the weight of multiple people at once. When workers jumped en masse from the top floors of the building, the nets ripped. Workers passed straight through them to the concrete, where they met a brutal demise. All told, 58 people died from impact with the sidewalk or street that night.
See, I always think that about the catching the net. A, that if I'm panicked and jumping from a roof, am I really going to hit that target well? And I'm trusting these guys are going to sight me, and I'm going to be close enough that they can move to catch me. But then the second fear I have is,
will it work?
It's just like a giant trampoline.
Right.
Am I going to go right through it, or am I going to bounce and then fly in the air another 50 feet somewhere else? It just, all along, I've never liked those things.
You've never liked those options from jumping from a building.
Yeah, they just don't seem to work.
Try to avoid it.
Now those giant, you see the stunt people for movies where it's like a giant air balloon that you're landing on. That's like the size
you
of
would do that.
Two pools. That seems like a little more likely than a round thing, 12 feet in diameter that 10 guys are holding. All right. Sorry for my little side rant and fear on that. The owners of the factory had previously committed insurance fraud by setting fires. Geez. Interesting. Triangle Shirtwaist Factory owners Isaac Harris and Max Blank should have placed proper firefighting equipment in their factories. This definitely would have prevented the disaster, or at least made it less deadly. However, such equipment costs money, and neither Harris nor Blank wanted to pay for it. Indeed, they had a history with fire. A number of mysterious blazes had broken out in their factories, conveniently taking out overstocked fabric once it was out of season.
Well, political corruption also created an environment in which workplace disaster thrived. New York City's political establishment certainly could have impassed standards on sweatshops like the Triangle Factory, but it didn't, because money talks, and the people who had money were the ones who owned the factories, not the ones trapped in them. There were prices to pay for everything in New York City. Even cops had to shell out $200 just to get their jobs, and even more if they wanted promotions. Firefighters accepted bribes, and in such an environment, no one was concerned with equipping firefighters with ladders taller than 6 stories and change, despite the proliferation of skyscrapers throughout the city. Building inspections were lax, enforcement of violations even more so. The workers of recent immigrants who were taken advantage of, no end to that sentence. They were the victims of this, right?
Yeah. They didn't have any choices.
Yeah.
You come there and then somebody recruits you. You don't speak the language. And suddenly you're basically indentured servant in a place.
So there were garment unions operating in New York City prior to the fire. In fact, several Triangle Shirtwaist Factory protested its working conditions several years prior, but this didn't change anything, though, until after the fire, when the city clamped down on sweatshops and put laws into place to protect employees. So this gets to our point. This is why you made this the history highlight of the day, and certainly made so many changes. But at the time of the fire, most of the people working at the Triangle Factory were recent immigrants or children of recent immigrants, many of whom barely spoke English. They didn't even realize that they could insist on better working conditions.
And, for some of them, they're coming from countries, and this is better, even though it's still terrible. Well, it's better than what they had.
It sounds like in that environment, too, if you did insist, you probably weren't going to keep your job either.
Yes, so why the doors were locked.
Right.
And you're fired and don't come back. And good luck trying to collect the wages we owe you.
Yeah, that's sort of a tough explanation too.
So having never really heard this story before, isn't that amazing? So many things that we kind of take for granted now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, of course you can't smoke in that kind of an environment.
In a garment factory.
And of course the doors open out and we want plenty of fire escapes.
I hadn't even thought about the doors opening out.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I kind of think about that anytime I'm in like any large audience somewhere and I look at the doors. I'm like, oh they open out. Thank goodness. Because when the crowd goes nuts.
Right.
At least they'll push me out.
I want to go out.
Rather than crush me against a door opening in.
Right.
So, it's just such a landmark case. That's one of the reasons historians know about it all the time. But this was the anniversary of it. And I was going to read all that myself, but I figured we should share that rather than me going into a huge in-depth version of the history highlight and why it was significant.
That's good. Yeah, we are safer today.
We are. And again, I don't feel like that's some strange, everything should be encroached on by government and we want inspections 12 times on anything.
Moderation.
Each day. Right. Yeah, there's a middle ground here.
But doing things correctly so that it's safe is huge, too. And I think that sometimes we also have to say that, you know, we aren't the experts in that either, right? I mean, I'm not an engineer, so I want somebody else to tell us.
Yeah. But I do know that I want a fire extinguisher that works or a fire hose that works.
Right.
And if I have to get on that fire escape, I would like it not to collapse or bend in the heat.
Right. Check your fire alarms, folks. Maybe this is the reminder, right?
Maybe that is. Yeah. And I do always, think of, and I mean, we kind of remember seeing it on TV with the 9/11, but anytime you see a fire in a major skyscraper, I'm always just like, how do the fire trucks get up there to them?
Oh,
and the fact that these poor fire guys have to haul the equipment up and
you can't, I have no idea.
You can't reach that high.
Yeah. How they can't have fires up there. That's well, there's sprinkler systems, right? So fire suppression systems exist so that there aren't huge fires.
I wonder when sprinkler systems were created.
Oh, that's
a good
one.
We should check into that. I wonder if it's as a result of this, if this is an impact on it.
Google it, folks.
All right. Yeah. Okay. So we haven't done this in a while.
We haven't.
Because we've had like just full giant shows with guests or topics that we actually ran out of time on. So this is kind of fun. But this is local history, this day in local history. So do you want to go ahead and...
Sure. I'll start with March 25th, 1931. 35 or 40 members of the Warrenton High School biology class made a longer stay in the vicinity of Cannon Beach's dead whale yesterday than any of them had anticipated. The class, led by Miss Louise Bartlett, journeyed into Cannon Beach and hiked south of Arch Cape to where the stranded monster lies on the beach. Interested in examining the big mammal was intense, and before any were aware, the tide had crept in and imprisoned the entire class on a small bit of land not far from the whale.
I kind of love how often beached whales come up into our local history.
It does, yes, 1931. And that they're so engrossed in this that they don't even notice that they're being isolated or stranded.
With the whale.
Right,
that's the part that kind of freaks me out. All right, so other things that we thought are kind of modern maybe, but are not. March 27th, 1917. Looking for a haunted house. Strange offer made for one to occupy it. There are various and devious thoughts running rampant throughout the world, but here is one that will hit your funny bone in a new place. A man in Oklahoma has written to Mayor Harley about a haunted house in Astoria, which, he says, they want a man to occupy it. The letter is rather crude, but it is worth reading. It says, I understand that there was a haunted house out there, and you offer a lot worth $2,000 for anyone to sleep in it one night. If I could get out there, I would sleep in the house now if there is anything in it. And if you would send me a pass up there, I will come up there and try around. And if you ain't got no haunted house, it will be all right. I ain't afraid to sleep in no house.
Especially for $2,000.
Yeah, no kidding. Yours truly, friend, signed A.L. Rust, Lone Wolf, Oklahoma. And the mayor answered, I have your very interesting communication of the 22nd, where there a haunted house anywhere in the city with a prize outstanding of $2,000 in any one sleeping in it one night or not 100 nights even. I should certainly move into it myself. The only like haunted house that I know of in Astoria is the City Hall, and the only persons haunting it are a lot of people who have considerable difficulty breaking in since last election.
Ooh.
Isn't that kind of funny?
That's an interesting one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a, yeah.
However, Astoria needs men of your caliber and courage, and while our budget contains no provision for transportation in cases of this kind, I can assure you, you will be given a warm welcome upon your arrival.
But we're not going to give you the $2,000. I mean, $2,000 in 1917.
That's
everybody would be staying
that's a middle
in that.
Class annual salary right there.
Right. Everybody would be staying in a haunted house for that amount.
I think he was just trying to get a free train ticket out.
Obviously, yes. The mayor was very courteous, right? Very political. So March 27th, 1930, Westport fishermen here swore at the herring today as they hauled out their boats to scrape the hulls and lost a good day's fishing. One of the largest herring runs ever witnessed occurred in Westport Cove a few days ago. The fish milled around several days. With the return of good weather, the fishermen turned their boats towards the harbor entrance, only to find them heavy and slow. Investigation disclosed that the herring had deposited almost inch-thick coatings of spawn on the hulls of the craft. While the fishermen scrape the salmon sport around outside the harbor, are gone without getting caught. I like that.
Yeah, that's just gross. March 28th, 1907, during the session of the State Board of Health, Dr. Alfred Kinney was questioned in regard to the Astoria Theater, and this led to a discussion in a general way relative to the sufficiency of the ways of egress from the gallery and the ventilation. Dr. Kinney, suggesting that the board be informed as to the conditions, good or bad, moved that the secretary be instructed to write Dr. Moan, city health officer, requesting examination of the premises. No, see, 1907, we're on it, not like the guys in New York City with the shirt tail factory.
Right. So is that the Liberty Theater then? The Astoria Theater?
Is I think the Astoria Theater is actually kind of like where the Wells Fargo is today.
Oh, okay.
But I could be wrong on that.
Interesting. And there's a theater, like a theater.
Oh,
theater.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them.
Not, yeah. Okay.
Vaudeville.
Right. March 28, 1931, keys to various drawers and compartments in the local post office building, formerly in the possession of H.F. Peacock, assistant postmaster, who disappeared last Thursday morning when postal inspectors arrived to inspect his books, were received today in the mail by Postmaster C.W. Halderman. No message accompanied the keys. The keys appear to have been mailed from San Francisco.
And we don't have this here, but I happen to know there's a follow-up to this like a week later. That he basically confesses that you don't pay me enough. I have a family to raise. And yeah, I took a whole bunch of money.
Oh.
But I deserved it because you don't pay me enough.
And here's the keys back. Yeah. Why did he have all these keys with him?
Because he felt badly. He felt badly that it's whoever is trying to do his job now.
Kind of like Newman on Seinfeld.
Yes. All right. March 28th, 1931. Two bootleggers nabbed by the sheriff's department entered pleas of guilty in the justice court today. J.D. Sheff, special traffic officer for the state of Washington, was arrested when the car he was driving was found to contain 12 gallons of liquor. He was fined $500 and sentenced to 60 days in jail. Sam D. Safford from Aberdeen was fined $350 for liquor possession.
Ooh. March 29th, 1894. The latest excitement in an upper town neighborhood is a haunted house.
Oh, see, here there we was go. One.
In the lonely hours of night, clumsy ghosts monkey around in the cat loft, fall over chairs and mash dishes when there's not any chairs and dishes there. Last night, the occupants of the house called in a neighbor to help keep watch for Mr. Ghosty, who made his presence felt by his usual antics at the hour of 12. The gentlemen on watch were armed to the teeth with guns, hatchets, and clubs, and as soon as the racket started in the garret, they commenced to run a bluff on Ghosty by pounding on the floor with their hatchets and hollering out that they would shoot. After this, the noise ceased, and the next mysterious round was at the back door as if trying to enter. They settled it. The occupants proceeded without any ceremony to take their departure out the front door. The affair is to be kept a secret.
And yet somebody reported it to the paper.
Right. And I stumble over all the words.
Yes. I like that they took hatchets and things to fight ghosts.
I was actually waiting for it to say that they found a mouse.
Yeah. Well, I wonder what they were thinking. If they thought it was just somebody goofing, so we're going to threaten them, or if they really thought like their hatchet would work against a ghost.
That's true, right?
But either way, that was 1894, so maybe that's what the guy thought that was writing from Oklahoma and wanting to come up here.
He'd heard about it.
I love reading these old stories from the paper. It's just very funny.
Yes, even when I stumble all over it.
All right, so be thankful you don't work in the shirtwaist factory, Triangle Factory, and go make some mystery. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical